From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The human rights investigator Anna Neistat says when you're trying to document an atrocity, trying to pin down a war crime, nothing compares to being on the ground. So as soon as something breaks, a team from the group Human Rights Watch is on the move. This is what they call their emergency team, the E-Team. They travel to some of the most dangerous places in the world, villages or neighborhoods in the aftermath of bombings and mass executions. One of the documentaries at the Sundance Film Festival this year profiles this E-Team, that's the name of the film, but it's not just about the crimes themselves, it's about the team. It can seem like a pretty hopeless job, and the film explains why they do it. Today in the program, we're live in Park City as we begin our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. We're talking about E-Team. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So it takes a certain type of person to travel to the most dangerous places in the world and ask questions. It's basically the job description for the investigators with the group Human Rights Watch. This is what they call their E-Team, their emergencies team. And the idea is to get there, wherever it is, while there's still smoke or rubble and memories are fresh. The job is to investigate and then to document human rights abuses, things like war crimes and genocide, and then they try and capture the world's attention. As one of the investigators explains in a new documentary film, they're not journalists, and their work isn't just about documentation, it's about trying to actually stop the killing. The film isn't about Human Rights Watch, though, or really about human rights abuses themselves. It's about the team and what kind of a person it does take to do this extraordinary work. The film is called E-Team, and it's in the documentary category at the Sundance Film Festival this year. Today in the program, we're beginning our coverage of Sundance with this film. We're live at the Swanner Eco Center in Park City this evening. Joining us is Ross Kaufman, who directed and produced E-Team, along with Kate Chiavini. She, among his other films we should mention, is, of course, Born into Brothels, which won the 2005 Academy Award for Best Documentary. Ross Kaufman, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Anna Neistat is with us, and Ola Solvang, also featured in the film. Neistat is an associate director for the program and emergencies divisions of Human Rights Watch. She has worked in Sri Lanka, in Russia, in Syria, many other locations around the world. And welcome to both of you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ola, I should mention, is a senior researcher for Human Rights Watch Emergencies Team, serves as a security advisor for HRW, has worked in a number of other countries as well. And we should also mention that Anna and Ola are married. You see that in the film. E-Team, we should mention, also premieres this Saturday as part of the festival. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. And thank you all very much for coming as well. Ross Kaufman, I wanted to start with you. This is a question I ask filmmakers all the time, and that is, I guess this will give us a sense of how you got started with all of this, but I want you to jump ahead a little bit and talk about, if this isn't jumping too far forward, when in the process did you realize, as you were kind of researching things and figuring out, when in the process did you realize, oh, this actually may work, this is actually a movie?
This was one of those films where you never know until Saturday at around 1:30 after the film is screened, and hopefully people like it. So you really don't know until then. But our feeling, Katie and I, when we were approaching the subject, is we didn't really know until we met our characters. Yeah. We had dinner with them in Brooklyn, and I was nervous because I thought, oh, human rights activists, you know, I don't want to meet these earnest people. And we had a great dinner. It was, we didn't talk that much about human rights. We just really enjoyed each other's company. And I think that's the key. You know, when you're doing a film like this, you're going to be spending years with these people.
Yeah.
And you want to know who you are, you know, about to spend that time with. So at that point, I really felt like, all right, I think there might be a film here.
Yeah. But you knew really from the start, it sounds like, that this was not a movie, this was not a film that you wanted to be about human rights, Human Rights Watch. It was a film about these characters and their work that they do.
The way I approach movies and the way Katie approaches movies, we are very strong believers that the most important thing is character. You know, once I can get people interested in caring about our characters, then they'll care about the issues, hopefully. Of course, I care about human rights, and I care about many issues around the world. But for me, making films is really about creating a sense of intimacy with my characters.
We should point out this is the first time Human Rights Watch really has granted this kind of access to a film crew. How did you talk them into it?
That's a good question. How did we talk them into it? I think it was a pretty natural fit. When we first started talking about this film, other filmmakers had wanted to make a film about Human Rights Watch. Other filmmakers had approached them at certain points. But when we approached them, I think it was pretty clear that Katie and I were coming from a place where we made quality films, where we knew what we were doing, and that we would... not necessarily protect, but that we'd come at it where we had full creative control. We knew that we would give our vision and the strength of our vision to the film. And right off the bat, they trusted that. And
I have to say that surprises me a little bit, because I would think that they would want not a propaganda piece, but they would want something that was about them, about the organization, not about four people in the organization.
I thought the same thing. And when we met Carol Bogert, who's here tonight, Carol was incredible. And we were very clear that not only do I want, and Katie want, 24-hour intimate access, I want to be able to film my characters. I actually think we're more collaborators, in their bedrooms, at certain times. We've had some moments where Anya would just come out of the shower and she'd be putting on her makeup and I'd knock on the door and barge into her, space. But so we wanted that intimate access, but more importantly, it was very clear from the get-go that there was no way we would embark on this kind of film, and we made it clear with Carol, and Carol was totally up for it, unless we had full creative control. And knowing that we would show Human Rights Watch and their work, warts and all.
Yeah.
And Carol, I'm still amazed that you said yes. I really am. So thank you.
Carol, actually, we have an excerpt from the film that features Carol because she raises an important question, which we'll get to here in a moment. I wonder, Ross, was there ever a moment where you figured that exposing their lives outside of this work... I mean, you didn't exactly give street addresses or anything like that, but we did see them in places outside of this. Was there ever a moment when you figured that this might be a little risky? Did that ever concern you?
Risky for... I'm sorry.
Well, they are exposing war crimes from some very powerful people, and did it ever worry you? I mean, was that ever part of the thing that you did worry a little bit about, that these are incredibly, or could be perceived as incredibly vulnerable people?
Well, I mean, there's always that thought that goes through my mind, whether I'm filming the kids in India,
yeah.
Whether I'm, whatever the case may be. But the real worry is about the people on the ground in these countries that we were following,
yeah.
The victims and the witnesses. And we were very clear that we would make sure, as much as humanly possible, that they were protected and that they knew what was going on when we were filming.
I want to get to Anna and Ula here, but let me start with a clip from the film that really raises some of the questions about the role of the emergencies team. This is Anna from a scene early on in the film. They're in Syria. They're there investigating human rights violations by the Assad regime. Here's a clip from the film, E-Team.
Nothing compares to being on the ground in the level of investigation that you can conduct.
How many were they? Was it a big group?
We almost never use just one interview to make a case. Because people sometimes exaggerate, sometimes they're just not truthful. So we interview several different people about the same crimes.
Do you remember what date it was when Sarmin was attacked?
war is hell, always. War is always bad. This is not our role to make this insightful statement. Our role is to show what exactly happened in this particular village and why we think this is a violation of international law.
Anna, you tell one woman in that scene that you make this clear, and I mentioned this in the introduction, you're not journalists. There's a difference. That you're not a journalist. Explain what the difference is, how you see your role on the ground.
Well, I think Human Rights Watch has this motto, investigate, expose, change, which I think explains quite well and in a very concise way the difference between us and journalists. It points to the similarity in some ways. We do work side by side with journalists, especially the emergencies team, or sometimes work in places where journalists do not get access, and we would become the main source of information for the media. But we always have to go one step further, both in terms of our analysis, because I don't know if you've ever seen a Human Rights Watch report. It's usually a pretty substantial document that goes into every single detail, not only of what we've documented, but of why this constitutes a violation, but also what needs to be done about this. And then the next step is actually creating change. We do not just leave it at exposing the violations. We take it to governments in question. We take it to international organizations like the United Nations that can have an impact. And a lot of the work starts right there. It cannot be done without the research. It cannot be done without the exposure. But our ultimate goal is actually to make sure that abuses stop, that legislature changes, that there are real improvements in the lives of people that we care about.
Ula, do you think of yourselves as advocates? Do you think that that your job there, when you're doing this interview, is as an advocate for them, or do you try to be dispassionate or impartial in some way, as an interviewer, as an investigator?
Well, I mean, it is a little bit of both. Ultimately, the credibility of Human Rights Watch and any organization in that position relies on us being able to be objective and impartial and to provide the facts as they are and not just one side of the story. At the same time, I think very often the most useful thing that we do, and definitely for me personally, the most meaningful thing I do in many of these cases, is to give a voice to the voiceless, to help those who cannot speak out, to help their voices reach an international audience, to reach the decision makers, and to make sure that their side of the story is heard as well, not just the politicians, not just the dictators, not just the military that are often behind these kinds of crimes.
Ross Kaufman, give us a sense of, and you go into this a bit in the film, kind of the history of the emergencies team at Human Rights Watch. I guess it had its origins in Kosovo. Kosovo is sort of an important touch point for the organization and for the team, it seems.
Absolutely. Fred Abrahams will be here on Friday, and he'll be at some of the screenings, tells the story of Kosovo and how out of that incredibly dire circumstance, the emergencies team was born. I don't want to give away the whole film, so.
Yeah, you don't have to. Yeah. I think that's it is interesting the way, because one of the dynamics that comes out in the film, and it's important for human rights, for the teams itself, is, again, not just the documentation part, not just the investigation part, but the change part. And it seems Kosovo was instructive, and Fred talks about this in the film, that if you just get the right photo out there, just the right information to the right kind of people that comes above the fold of the New York Times, as the one particular story does, it can change kind of everything.
Yeah, as Fred says, it did change the tenor of that conversation about Kosovo in the war room. It's one of those things where it's also a combination of things. It's a combination of the research. It's a combination of the work that goes into interviewing all these different victims and interviewing the perpetrators. You know, Human Rights Watch, not only interviews victims, but they actually work on both sides of a conflict. Kosovo is it was a pretty incredible turning point for Fred, and it seemed like the team at Human Rights Watch, to think, you know what, this is something where we can bring it forward and we can create a team of people who actually do really get on the front lines of these conflicts and can create change, not only immediately, but through their reports and through their incredibly exhaustive research on the ground.
So, Anna and Ulla, you don't want to sensationalize it. You don't want to oversimplify it, but you do want to get people's attention. So what are you looking for? Are you looking for an image? Are you looking for numbers? I mean, I guess all of that, maybe.
Yes, it's a combination, and I think I hope that's one of the messages that people will get from the film, is exactly what is this all about. It's all of these things that you mentioned. It really goes from meticulously collecting data, including satellite imagery, including locations, including really tons and tons of data, analyzing. Peter in the film talks a lot about how we work on weapons recognition, battle damage assessment, so lots and lots of evidentiary techniques, of course, interviewing, but it's also the other part of it, which is you cannot just get people involved and create change by presenting this raw data, no matter how accurate it is. Mm-hmm. You have to have the story, you have to have, as Ulla said, the voice and the image. Now, for example, over the last few years, we work more and more with photographers, with videographers. We're trying to tell the story through many different means to get people engaged, both the general public and the policymakers and those who have the strings in their hands that we want to pull.
But just to interject, not just some videographers and some photographers, and I'm not talking about myself, they work with the best photographers in the world. And much to, you know, applause to you, Carol, but literally, to get some of these photographers, I mean, sometimes we're in the field with some of these photographers, and they're people I've been looking up to for years. And so they really take seriously not only just getting a picture, but getting an incredibly strong photograph and an incredibly strong document to speak to people on an emotional level. And I think that's incredible. So.
And we see that it works. I mean, that's also the thing. We choose the best photographers and videographers because it has enormous impact on our audiences, probably much more than just a written word would have.
Ulla, I wonder, there are a number of moments in the film where you get a sense of skepticism from reporters. There's this fascinating press conference in Russia that Anna has to go through, this series of amazingly skeptical responses from people. But do you get that a lot? Do you get the sense of skepticism? How can you confirm this? How can you verify this? I mean, do you have to deal with the sense of skepticism as a part of your job?
I mean, it is usually one of the first questions that any reporter asks us when we give an interview, and it's probably one of the first questions that they should be asking. And that is because, and I think we're seeing this so well in Syria now, the propaganda on both sides is so intense, and it's extremely difficult for any decision maker, any politician, to sort of sift through, you know, what is exaggeration, what is what are lies, and what is the truth in it. And I think that's where we play an incredibly important role as being an impartial, objective organization, going in there, conducting very meticulous investigation, and then presenting the conclusions in a non-political, non-biased way. In Syria, for example, we have been critical of both the government and the opposition, and we've documented abuses by both. And having that kind of credibility based on that thorough investigation, I think, is really what sometimes can make our work have a lot of impact.
Ross, was it... I'm thinking of a moment early in the film when you have to, Ulla and Anna have to illegally cross the border from Turkey into Syria. And it seemed pretty dicey.
Clandestinely,
right. That's right. Better word. Talk a little bit about that part of it, the sort of danger they're exposed to, the creativity that they have to express and use.
It's interesting because I'm a nice Jewish kid from upstate New York. I was not raised to do this kind of stuff. There's right. No one in my family. You know, I wasn't, for the record, we had an incredibly strong team of filmmakers as well. I was on a few of the missions in Syria and Libya, but we had a woman named Rachel Beth Anderson, a young photographer and filmmaker who was on that particular mission that you're talking about, and a man named James Foley, another wonderful filmmaker who was on some other missions. So it wasn't just me out there, first of all. And as far as we're concerned, my mom doesn't know any of this, right. So please don't tell her.
Okay.
It's part of their job. The interesting thing for me is, it's almost, I mean, they do extremely meticulous, they have extremely meticulous security protocols, but at the same time, like, these two are like, oh yeah, we'll do it, we'll get it done, and, yeah. You know, but at the same time, they take it very seriously.
Yeah.
So it's like there's this almost split personality.
There's a great moment when, I shouldn't say great, but a fascinating moment where there has been a bombing in Azaz in Syria.
Oh,
they just found out about it. Ula and Anna, and the question is, should we go? It just happened maybe a half an hour ago, as you learn. And Ula's face is sort of priceless because he's sort of wincing, and Anna's like, of course we should go, or maybe we should go. I mean, how are you thinking? I mean, Ula, what are you thinking about that? Because you want to get there, but then it didn't seem like such a great idea to me.
Yeah. It is a dilemma, and it is for me a very strong personal dilemma, because I'm part, you know, 50% of my time is as a researcher, and I'm supposed to be going after these situations and get the facts and get the information. The other 50% of my responsibility is as a security advisor for the organization. So I'm supposed to be holding back the researchers
right.
who wants to do this.
Yeah.
So I find myself in sort of slightly schizophrenic situations, and that was one of them, definitely. But I think we do take security quite seriously. And part of that is always weighing the potential benefit against the potential risk. And looking at, if we take this risk, first of all, what kind of risk is it? And is it worth what we would be able to do with it? And is there any other way that we could get this information? In the situation in Syria, in a situation like this where dozens, if not hundreds of people are dying by aerial bombardment from the government, and where the facts are really disputed between the two parties, there is really no alternative to going to where the aerial bombardments are taking place. And that means at some point you are taking the risks of being relatively close to some of those bombardments as well. In this particular case, you know, our concern was that there was a pattern of, after one bombardment, the government would come back and bomb the same place again, leading to very, very heavy casualties, because people would be going to that place trying to help the injured and wounded. But we also knew that usually happened within sort of 5-10 minutes of the first. So the fact that it had happened, you know, it was now half an hour after, made me slightly more comfortable going there.
And that's a great example of the amount of meticulous research and information that you do, not only when you're on the ground, but before you get into these situations. I've been with war photographers who have no information whatsoever, and they just go for it. And it's sad, actually. So I always felt extremely safe going in any situation with the two of you and Peter and Fred, even though they might not be the safest situations. But if you're going to go into a situation like that, I'd go in with you guys anytime.
I want to play another scene from the film. This is in Arabic, so you won't be able to understand what this woman is saying, but it gives a sense of a particular moment here that I wanted to ask you about. There's a woman in Syria who's talking about how three of her sons where she's talking about taken from their home, shot and killed in the street. And the question that I had during this moment, and Anna is talking to her, how do you see your role when someone is expressing this kind of sadness? I mean, how empathetic can you be? Let me play this moment first from the film E-Team. This woman is kind of resigned at this point, and she's saying, what's the point of writing, and what's the point of talking? And she says that, she could fill gallons with her tears, she could make a river. Now, part of you, Anna, you're investigating this, you're documenting this, but the other part of you is, I'm wondering how much of that is you, a mother, reacting? When, what part of this is you dispassionately trying to document? Which patch part of it is it wants to give her a hug?
Yeah, I think it's one of the most difficult dilemmas and questions. And I think I do always try to remain very professional, because I do feel that on one hand, of course, as a mother, I could just sit there crying with her for hours, but would that really help? Is that why I'm there? Absolutely not. And so I really try to stay somewhat distant. That doesn't mean non-sympathetic, but somewhat distant, because, I also need to get the facts. Yeah. And that's the most difficult part, when this woman is crying and I still need to ask her all these questions to be able to document this particular crime. But I think that what really gives me the, I guess, the impulse, the strength to continue doing this, is that many of these women, no matter how much they lost, and we have no way of understanding it. There is no way to express your sympathy in a way that would be meaningful, at least to me. You cannot say I understand. You cannot say I. But how many of them do understand what we do? It's absolutely fascinating. I don't know. I think there is probably another interview in the movie where it's a similar situation: a mother who lost two of her sons and several other relatives, and it's a horrible situation. But she says, "Don't sit here," and that's for me is like the quintessential moment. You don't have to. Don't say you're sorry for me. Don't express your sympathy. Just go and do what you can do for me. What I cannot do. Go and tell this to the world. Go and make sure that people who did it do not get away with that. And I think even when people don't express it so clearly, it's somehow there always, or in many situations. And I think that's what allows me to really focus on what I'm doing, rather than being completely devastated, which it is devastating sometimes.
Anna Neistat is with us, Associate Director of the Human Rights Watch Emergencies Division. Ola Solvang, Senior Researcher for the division. And Russ Kaufman is with us. He directed and produced E-Team. The Saturday at noon, E-Team is going to premiere as part of the 2014 Sundance Film Festival. It's at the Egyptian Theater in Park City. For other screenings in Salt Lake, Park City, and at Sundance, go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We're live at the Swanner Eco Center in Park City, and we're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This evening on the program, we're live at the Swanner Eco Center in Park City as we begin our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. Tonight, we're talking about a film in the documentary category of the festival called E-Team. It's a profile of the lives of four human rights workers, investigators for the group Human Rights Watch. E-Team stands for Emergencies Team, and these four go out and gather evidence and interviews in some of the most dangerous places in the world, which seems like a hopeless job, but the film explains why it is that they do it. We have with us Ross Kaufman, co-director of the film, produced the film as well. And Anna Neistat is with us. Ola Solvang also with us. They're featured in the film. They're joining us here at the Swanner Eco Center in Park City. Russ Kaufman, I wanted to ask you about Peter Buchart, Belgian national living in Geneva. He was called in a Rolling Stone magazine article the James Bond of human rights investigators, known as the Bang Bang guy. He's interested in weapons. Talk a little bit about Peter as a character in the film.
I could go on and on and on about Peter as a character. He's a lovely guy. Peter is the kind of person that... How can I describe Peter? It's hard to describe Peter, but he's an amazing guy. He is a person who says what he feels, no matter who's in the room, no matter what effect he's going to have on people. But at the same time, he has an incredible heart. And this is something I saw many times. And the E Team members did not show much emotion, quite frankly. You are pretty tough characters, but there were times when Peter really I saw another side of him that I didn't really know was there.
Let me play another clip from the film. This is a section where, and this is kind of this. What I detected is this kind of ongoing theme in the film. This contrast that you establish between the lives that the E Team lives in their place in Paris or in their place in Brooklyn or in Berlin, and Peter has a place kind of in this bucolic farm outside of Geneva, and you see him riding around with his kids, which is such an interesting sort of contrast to the life of him going into this slaughterhouse in Libya, which we may get to. It's extraordinary, but it's interesting because in essence you're asking him why it is he does what he does, and he's kind of matter of fact about it. Here's another clip from the film E Team.
It's a completely different life from the life I live out on the road, like the horrible things that we come across. Why do we end up becoming a human rights activist? It's not like, some light went off or that's what I wanted to do since I was a little boy. It's just something I do. It's about fighting back against bad people. And that in itself gives you a rush. It's nice to be on the right side. And it's nice to fight back. There goes a certain level of satisfaction with f***ing with bad people.
We bleeped that out. What do you think he means, that there's a rush? What do you think he means by that?
There are many times, and it's a little bit cliche to say, but when I was working on a possible series about war photographers, and one war photographer said something really incredible. He said, it's... To be on the front lines of history is one of the most incredible feelings and one of the most incredible experiences. And I remember he said this is sort of before I went to any of these places with you guys, and I thought, it sounds so cliche. But it's true, for me anyway. I remember going to Libya with Peter and Fred and coming back, and my wife Addie can attest to this. I was so amped up for, a number of weeks because it was really exciting. And at the same time, it was a little bit dangerous at that point. But there's a rush you get, and it's very strange. It's contradictory feelings of being so excited to be in a place, but also knowing it's a terrible place and it's horrible things are happening. It's for me personally. So.
Did you find a characteristic that draws them all together?
I did not. They're such different characters. That's part of what Katie and I loved about that first dinner when we met you guys. They were so different across the board. And I kept looking for things that were, Anya's very, they share that common. Not really.
There's some things that draw us together.
Well, you two maybe. You are married after all. They're all extremely different, fascinating characters, and I was always discovering different aspects of their personalities as we were filming. And yeah, it's very interesting. Even now, it's been fun. It's so nice to finish a film and just be able to spend time with people. That's the other thing. I actually have this love-hate relationship with filmmaking because I just want to hang out with my collaborators or characters, and then I have to pick up the camera and, you know, things get a little dicey.
Here's another little moment, which I thought was really interesting, revealed something about Anna. Anyway, she's talking about being a kid growing up in Russia. I'll just play this clip and we can talk a little bit about it.
You know, I remember when I was whatever, definitely younger than Donnie's now, so maybe 10. I decided to convince my entire class to quit the Young Pioneers organization because I was like, we're wearing these red scarves. We don't believe in it. We don't support it in any way. Why this formality? So that was a huge scandal. I almost got kicked out of school.
I'm thinking, you know, so you're always seeing, have you always seen injustice everywhere you go, even when you were little?
Let's put it this way. When I go back to this same school now, even with Daniel sometimes, none of my teachers are particularly surprised by what I do. Which I guess, although, you know, that, as Peter says, that was not my plan exactly to become a human rights activist when I was younger. But I think, you know, it was just the time. I mean, there was no escape from it. I was a teenager when the Soviet Union was falling apart, and it was just so natural to... you know, we saw these completely different narratives, the official narrative and the what's really was going on. So, and, you know, we saw, you know, how some historical injustices are being corrected. And, you know, finally, you know, when you see something like a major totalitarian system sort of crumbling and eventually crushing in front of your eyes, that does give you a very serious stimulus to do something like that. But, yeah, I guess, no, this scene, yeah that's...
Ulla, what about you? I mean, were you like that? Looking for injustices to correct even when you were a kid?
Well, I think here's the thing. I think despite being married, I think Anya and I are very different. So where I think Anya's driving motivation, for her human rights work is rebellion against any kind of authority, then my driving motivation is exactly the opposite. You know, as being a good Scandinavian, I'm all for following rules and regulations, right. And I get pissed when dictators don't follow their own rules. And that, you know, in most of the cases when we're dealing with bad regime, we're on the same page. I think some of the worst fights that we have are when it comes to internal Human Rights Watch rules and regulations, where we have very different approaches. Mm.
Ross, this is an important part of the film, though. I have to say, that contrast between Anna and Ulla. I mean, she's fiery and wants to... And Ulla, he's got this calm, kind of measured sensibility. I mean, it's a terrific part of the film, I have to say.
There are a lot of outtakes, let me just tell you that. Our producer, Marilyn Ness, is here, and we often talk about how we have plenty for a TV series on the cutting room floor, and we hope to do that at some point. But there are so many scenes that I had to leave out of this film that just show that.
Thankfully
you left out of the film, but I just love them. But for me, this is another thing about this film for me, and Katie and I were very clear about this. You know, we didn't want to make another earnest documentary about an issue.
Yeah.
We wanted to show people, but we also show... I mean, the humor in this film, I think, comes through. And, you know, in the darkest places, there is hopefully some joy and a lot of times some dark and sometimes some light humor. And I'm a big believer that that must come through in these films because that just makes it much more relatable. And you really understand that these characters are just not so dire all the time. But they actually... real people.
Ulla getting a haircut at a safe house in Syria. It's a great scene.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I love about films like these that can really show, you know, all the different aspects of being a person, a human being.
I want to ask you about a moment in the film where Anna and Ulla, you are you become convinced, or you think that there should be a no-fly zone over Syria. And so you want to make this case. There's a conference call, and then you go to New York to the headquarters of Human Rights Watch to essentially have this debate or make this case. And it's incredibly controversial, of course, because people are worried about the unintended consequences of something like this, and you've got an organization like Human Rights Watch, and if it decides to say there should be a no-fly zone, that could mean military intervention, that's a big deal. You know, when do you... So this is a very big part of the film, and I have to say this was the moment when you really seemed kind of frustrated, or not frustrated with the process, but the fact that there is a give and take in this organization. I wanted you to talk about that, about not everyone always agrees in these moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no question about it. That was, and you know, it continues to be a difficult discussion at Human Rights Watch. What do we do about Syria? Yeah. What do you do about a situation like that, where it seems like the whole geopolitical dynamics, you know, and talking about the Security Council in particular, it's so deadlocked that it seems impossible to do anything. And, you know, as Anya mentioned in the beginning, that's why we're doing our job, to try to change and to try to bring an end to these human rights violations. You know, we had, after having worked on the ground and documenting all these aerial bombardments and arriving at some of them or being at, you know, very close to some of them, we felt very strongly that we needed to make that call. But it was a very difficult question, and there were very reasonable people arguing both sides of that argument. And in the end, I think the organization felt that it was just such an unpredictable situation that at that moment in time, we could not come forward and have a recommendation for a no-fly zone, which is a form of military intervention, because it was so unpredictable and we could end up making things worse, or that kind of intervention yeah. could end up making things worse. And, you know, we have certain ground principles that we try to stick by very, very closely. And one of them is to do no harm. So in this situation... there were a lot of people inside the organization who felt that we could not be sure enough that we would not be doing harm by coming out with the recommendations like that. But I think it goes to show how frustrating a situation like Syria can be. We've had some impact in terms of what we've done, but it's been extremely difficult to be, for now, 3 years documenting the violations we have been doing, and without seeing any improvement. On the contrary, we see, you know, the situation worsening in many ways.
But if I could just add one line to that, I think that's also the moment in the movie where you see, of course, most of it is focused on the emergencies team, but this is one of the moments where you see the rest of the organization. Human Rights Watch is not just the emergencies team. It's 400 people who do incredibly important work, but there is this one moment where you actually see and you hear them talk and you hear their arguments, and absolutely, I would not deny at that moment, you know, we are frustrated and these moments come up, but you also see that you hear from people who are real specialists in what they do. We have people who may not be doing this work on the ground, but who know everything there is to know about Syria or Middle East. We have people who may not be doing this work on the ground, but who are incredible, world bestest experts on international law. And that's exactly, you see a little bit of how decisions are made at Human Rights Watch, which I think is very important.
Here's another moment. This is Carol Bogert. Bogert, she's the deputy director of Human Rights Watch. And it's this moment, it's after this debate has gone on, and she's talking about, in some ways, how, I guess in some ways she sympathizes. And she says something really interesting, the idea of how people have entrusted you with their stories. Here's another scene from E-Team.
It eats us up every day. And I think it really eats up Anya and Ole. Look, I've never been to Syria in my life. I haven't looked those people in the eye. You know, these people who repose in you the sacred trust of their story. Like, they tell you about their son, who was their son, or their five-year-old daughter. How did they die? They tell you these stories, and then, you know, you walk away and you carry those stories with you. You know, as you can hear, there's like hundreds of people dying every day. What do we do? What do we do? How do we prevent that? What can we say that will stop that?
We are talking about the film E-Team. Russ Kaufman is with us, co-director and producer of the film, along with Kate Chivini. Anna Neistat is also with us, associate director of the Human Rights Watch Emergencies Division. Ola Solvang, senior researcher for the division. Saturday at noon, E-Team is premiering as part of the Sundance Film Festival. It's at the Egyptian Theater in Park City. There are other screenings in Salt Lake, in Park City, in Sundance. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. Listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This evening on the program, we're beginning our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. For the last few years, we've been focusing on the documentaries at the festival, and this evening we're broadcasting live from the Swanner Eco Center in Park City, talking about a film called E-Team. It's a profile of the lives of four human rights workers. We have with us the co-director, Ross Kaufman. We also have two of the workers featured in the film, Anna Neistat and Ola Solvang. We'll give you the details about where the film is screening here as we go along. Ross, I wanted to ask you something about... there's a moment with Anna. This is in Paris. And we see these scenes with Ola and Anna, and there's this moment when their son, Danya, is talking to them, and Ola is trying to say, you're very straightforward, and you're trying not, but he seems like, man, that would be really scary, and you're trying to talk to him about all of this, and then I guess the next day, there's this scene where Anna is gardening at their apartment outside in Paris, outside, and there's this moment where someone asks her, I'm not sure if it's you, but asks her if Danya gets scared. I want to play this scene, but I want you to talk about this moment, because it's interesting. I wanted to get a sense of what you made of that moment.
What did I make of that moment? Yes, it was me. I asked that question. I don't like asking questions. I like just letting things happen. But every so often, after a night like that, I have some questions, and I need to ask them. And I just was curious as to what you would say. I mean, it's very, this kid, I see something. You see maybe something different. So for me, I really wanted to ask her just straightforwardly, what do you think about this? And you'll see the answer. So.
Does he ever talk to you about being scared?
Scared of what?
Scared for you guys?
Well, he did last night.
No, but in general, does he ever talk to you about being scared?
No. I actually don't think he's scared. No. I mean, he's 12 years old. Do you remember yourself when you were 12? The idea that you or anybody else can die. It's such an abstract. And he's not the most, as you could see, he's very safe. He's very secure. I mean, I guess if you ask him, point blank, are you scared that, your mother can die in one of those situations, he probably will say yes. But honestly speaking, I don't think it's part of his sort of everyday nightmares.
No, is she? Wait. Is she in denial?
That's.
I'll just note for the record, Danya's in the audience, and
he
said yes that she is.
I think Danya should be the person who should answer that question. That's not for me to say.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, I have my own thoughts, my own feelings, but that's not for me to say. I'd rather other people come to the conclusions that they come to, but maybe that's a question for Anya. I don't know. It's like a game show.
Well, first of all, he's now 2 years older. And I think probably now he's much more aware of what is going on, what could happen. And in some ways I would probably filter the information that he gets about what we do much more than we used to. Because I honestly, I think I'm very sincere in this scene. I really, it might
feel like I'm in denial, but I don't think so. And it's not about the fact that I don't care how he feels, but no. I don't think by, you know, making more out of it and, you know, that would add anything. I think it's keeping him safe and secure yeah. and making sure that he knows that, you know, we'll do absolutely our absolute best to always be there for him.
Yeah.
But I think there's also a sense of, you know, we often get that question, you know, or that sort of comment, what you're doing is so risky and how do you deal with that? And, you know, when you come down to it, it's all relative. You know, everybody takes a certain level of risk every day. And, you know, driving in Moscow is you know, probably, you know, a much bigger risk than we take on most days. And then you have situations that are, of course risky. But we do take that serious. We try to reduce risk as much as possible. And to be quite honest, I don't think we feel unsafe most of the time. Of course, there are moments. But most of the time, we feel we're out there doing our job and we don't feel particularly at risk. So I think there's a little bit of that going on as well. This is our job and we've sort of gotten used to it. I think Danya has gotten used to it and other people involved with us.
And the other thing is, I, having known you both for a while now, and Peter and Fred, it's all relative.
Yeah.
I mean, the people that they work with on the ground in these countries that are the victims, that are the witnesses, they are the people who are in constant danger. And, you know, I think in asking you that question, you know, if I just asked you that question alone as a scene that's all people see, well, then maybe Jan is in denial. But the fact that you get this whole sense over the film that it's not about them.
Yeah.
And they don't think it's about them.
Yeah.
And, you know, they know. And now I know it's about the people on the ground, and it's about helping them and being being there for them. So I don't think Anya and Peter and Fred and Ule really think much about themselves that much.
There's one question that I don't like. It's this one. Just because I feel that it's just so irrelevant because, you know, we talk to people who lose their loved ones, who live in this constant sense of danger, that asking us about, you know, how dangerous this work is, it's just always, it just doesn't add up.
Yeah. So you're saying my questions are irrelevant?
Well, that's obvious.
That's obvious, yes, of course.
We are pretty much out of time, but let me ask one more question. Let me make another run at one that might be more relevant. And this kept coming back to me. Is this kind of life sustainable for you two? I mean, forget the danger part, just the hearing, you know, because there's a moment, I think, where you say there was a time when I swore I would never go back to Syria because what's the point? You know, what's really changing? Well, you mentioned it before. It's frustrating. It doesn't seem like anything's changing in Syria right now. So is that kind of emotionally, is that sustainable as a life?
We discuss potential retirement options every now and then, but so far we haven't come up with anything.
Well, I think the two of us actually have a great advantage in that we do exactly the same thing. And that's another question we often get, how that sort of impacts the way we work and the way we... And, you know, it ends up being you never stop working.
Yeah.
Because it's sort of, you know, we do exactly the same. We interact and gossip about exactly the same colleagues. And and so it's there's never sort of a, okay, that was my working day and this is my personal life. But at the same time, there's an understanding between the two of us that I don't think you could ever have with somebody who is doing something completely different. So in that sense, I think we're, you know, emotionally, I find that, you know, being able to talk to Anya about these things and share it when you have difficult moments is tremendously important. It is probably not sustainable. And also logistically, you know, we now have a much younger son who's 4 months. And that means that we have to make adjustments in terms of how we work. We love working together and traveling to Syria together. But we probably can't do that logistically and for other reasons. I think we need to make sure that one person stays at home all the time.
But I honestly, I don't see us doing something dramatically different in the near future.
Does that surprise you, Ross, at all?
Not at all.
Ross Kaufman directed, co-directed and produced E-Team along with Kate Chiavini. Anna Neistat is the Associate Director of the Human Rights Watch Emergencies Division. Zola Silvong is the Senior Researcher at the division. E-Team premieres Saturday at noon at the Egyptian Theater in Park City, part, of course, of the Sundance Film Festival this year. For details on that and other screenings, visit us online at radiowest.kuer.org. Thank you very much, you three, for being
Thank
with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Let me say that Radio West is a production of KUER News, with thanks to Sally Tauber at the Swanner Eco Center and to Geraldine Dreyfus of the Utah Film Center. Thanks also to Anna Sprouse and to KUER's Mike Anderson and Lewis Downey. Michael Havey directed tonight's broadcast. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.